You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, August 5th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the award-winning The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City on today's program, Rafia Zakaria, Pakistani journalist on how ISIS is using women in Iraq to enforce a brutal regime of oppression of females, basically, and more broadly, how oppression of women plays out in war zones. We're going to go over that with her and how we can address these crises without playing into Orientalism. There's a lot at stake here. Interesting, upsetting. Also, Stephen Colbert owned Campbell Brown. She's gone from CNN to school privacy advocate. Why can't she just be out searching for the Malaysia plane? Why does she have to be trying to ruin our education system? Steve King had an interaction with a dreamer, and it may actually surprise you. That's how bad it was. You hear that and you think, that's got to be bad.
This might even seem even weirder, though, but Steve King's response is actually the better response compared to another Republican congressman who's standing right there next to Steve King.
Constitution!
Yeah, that's a small hint. Yeah.
My hint about who that other one was. Also, retired Israeli general, no such thing as civilians in Gaza. Oof. As all of that continues and unfolds, what else we got, Matt?
We also got the latest on this Benghazi report in terms of what's being reported out there. It will be not shocking to you at all who is ignoring this Benghazi report that shows there is no scandal. Open carry advocates have found a new demographic to advertise to: your young children.
Nice.
And the wonderful story of a Republican congressman who's found the real problem going on in America, the real wars waging, folks. And it's not against women. It's not against immigrants. It's not even against just men. It's against whites.
I was going to give you an obscure hint. I was going to say constatation. All right, folks. Thank you for joining us on a Matt and Mike Tuesday. Sam is away on a personal family matter. He's fine. His immediate family is fine. Everything is okay, but it is something he needed to attend to. He will be back tomorrow. We're going to take a brief break. Be right back with Rafia Zakaria. Thanks for listening.
Say, here comes trouble, here comes the danger, sent by the savior. Welcome the Rasta youths. I and I start recruit soldiers for Selassie army. Hey. Here comes trouble, here comes the danger, welcome the savior, welcome the Rasta youths. You're not for axes who are the general issue in a warning.
Ja people them a ball, said them tired of mediocre. Evil a go fall when we tread in Ethiopia. Me leaving from down, cause them life no easy boat, ya. Even Bantan said it's not an easy go. Operation, occupy the motherland. Calling all soldiers to kind each other along. From creation, he writing a job plan, but chronics can't do it alone. So I'm recruiting soldiers coming from near and far. I choose executing Selassie I works and be lost a far right truth. And them say, here comes trouble, here comes the danger. Sent by the Savior, welcome the Rasta youth.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Jamal Brooks. That's Chronix. I feel like a DJ right now. Okay, joining us right now is Rafia Zakaria. She's a journalist who writes for the Dawn newspaper in Pakistan and Al Jazeera America. Rafia, it's great having you on. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure as always. Now, you have a piece that you wrote a couple of weeks ago, and I'm glad to finally that we were finally able to make this work, and you can come on and talk about it. The name of the piece is Women Watching Women, and what you're talking about is a brigade that has been set up in cities controlled by ISIS, which is this, you know, really fanatical militia, terrorist organization, I guess however you want to define it, that's been rolling through Iraq and attempting to create some type of imagined caliphate. Now, you're talking about the specific role that women are playing in what they're doing, and then more broadly, why the oppression and abuse of women. I mean, we see this obviously with the Taliban or Boko Haram and now with ISIS. What is it specifically, before we get to this brigade and some of the specifics, what is the broader context of why women are targeted so specifically and so relentlessly in a situation like this?
First of all, yeah, it's great to be on and to be talking about this. As someone, you know, who writes about women, both in Pakistan, where I'm from, as well as just feminism in general and the global linkages between feminists. I've been writing for a long time about how various extremist groups like Boko Haram, the Taliban, and now IS or Islamic State, as they're called, use sort of the visuals of oppressing women as a means of showing their political control over an area. And, you know, when I started writing about this 5 or 6 years ago, when the Taliban first marched into Swat in Pakistan, this was still it was unusual to see this sort of extreme and sudden clampdown on women in the public space, as well as, you know, a very deliberate sort of tableau of either flogging women or stoning them or oppressing them and recording that and making it available to wider web-based public was a new thing. But as we've seen the emergence of more and more of these groups, and as sadly, they have been able to take over more and more territory in places as diverse as, you know, as I mentioned, not just Pakistan anymore, but also Afghanistan, Nigeria, and now parts of Syria and Iraq. This strategy of, showing political control by eliminating women from the public sphere has become a standard in their sort of, in the agenda that they have, and also in the visuals and aesthetics of sort of medievalism and barbarism that they use to cow populations and to make people afraid. The particular article, Women Watching Women, honed in on a particular strategy that's being used by Islamic State, in which they're basically formed a brigade of women. And as I mentioned in the article, this is not in itself something new, right? Because both in Iran and in Saudi Arabia, there are all women's police forces that kind of go around and enforce, you know, these rigid parameters of dress and behavior on other women. So the incident that I was talking about in relation to this brigade, which is called the Al-Khansa Brigade, was in the Syrian city of Raqqa, where a young girl was walking unescorted, and she was rounded up by this brigade and held in detention for hours, where she was, you know, abused, left alone. She didn't know why she was there. She didn't know when she would be let back. And then until finally she was let go. And so, you know, the strategy, again, is very similar, is that, you know, now instead of men enforcing these punishments, they've come up with this idea of using women to oppress other women. And what that does is essentially resurrect, ironically, a very colonial trope. Because as post-colonial societies in Pakistan and Nigeria, that's what the colonists did. You know, it's, you know, when the British came to South Asia, to what is now India and Pakistan, they used, you know, they would select certain groups to then enact the colonialist policies over other groups in that typical sort of divide and rule metric that we're, you know, all familiar with. So I was pointing out essentially how these groups that actually vowed to be very anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist, actually use the same tactics that we've seen used in these regions and actually resurrect these very colonial tropes of using one, some, you know, selecting some members of an oppressed group to receive some power and then, you know, use them to enforce that over the rest of the group.
Yeah, and the other thing that is fascinating that strikes me as you're talking about is you're talking about the power of the visual representation of this very specific type of oppression. I mean, it's very interesting if you look at the Western presentation of a group like the Taliban. It's almost actually like women's bodies and women's being erased from the public space is part of this odd kind of allure or threat in the imagery, not just a demonstration of a human rights abuse, as an example. So when you're talking about resurrecting these colonial systems, it also seems like there's this other odd parallel between how some on the West, in the West, who have a particular political agenda in the Middle East or South Asia want to kind of represent certain societies in certain ways, they gravitate towards this imagery too. So there's this symmetry going on, and it's playing out through women's bodies.
You're precisely right. I mean, what I'm trying to point out first, of course, is that there are a very intentional aesthetics to the forms of domination that these groups are exercising. And it's very intentional, and it is meant to provide a certain kind of visual to people who are watching, both in the local populations and internationally. And the second point that you mentioned is crucial, and it's kind of a tale of two perversities, right? Because in one sense, these extremist groups know and seem to capitalize on the fact that people in the West will respond to these highly orientalized, grotesque, brutalized images in a certain way, because for a long time that's been sort of the dark corner of the Western imagination. And so it's a symbiotic sort of mechanism at this point, where they produce these visuals, they know that they're going to be disseminated widely and written about globally, and in a sense that gives them a certain kind of notoriety and even perhaps a kind of local legitimacy, because then, you know, they're no longer local groups. IS is not just a ragtag group that's taking over one and two and three provinces in a in one part of the world, but it sort of showcases their transnational ambitions. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, again and again, I've written about how the terms that they use, especially, and these visuals, for example, just, you know, the sequestering of women, there is no precedent in that, you know, in the Islamic world, even when, for example, the caliphate existed prior to that, you know, Muslim women have been playing a huge role in society. They've never been sequestered or harassed in this way. But, I mean, you know, the fact is that these groups are not really concerned with the sort of doctrinal or historical or religious rightness of their actions. What they're concerned with is creating an aesthetic opposite to modernity and presenting that to the world as a sort of challenge to a certain kind of way of justice, of ordering society. And, you know, women's bodies especially have become the battleground for sort of their essential ingredients in constructing this aesthetic. So because, you know, women's swaths and burqas or women completely absent from the public sphere creates a statement like no other. It's an instantly and radically transformed public sphere. And that has become, like I said, a cornerstone of kind of the aesthetics of barbarism or neo-medievalism that they want to embody.
Right. And so getting to the women who make up this brigade, and obviously, of course, there's a level of conjecture and speculation here, but this is another sort of area where there's some interesting possible distinctions. So in Iran, as an example, obviously the Islamic Republic of Iran does not have a good record on women's rights. Now, that said, I think especially in the beginning of that revolution, there was sort of hybrid rhetorics about giving women certain power and sort of their role in that particular type of revolution. Now, obviously, this question is, you know, I'm getting away and sort of disaggregating from, you know, I think we all can agree on just the kind of objective, horrific human rights abuses and cruelty to women and to everybody that is coming under the fire and the gaze of this group. But so with that acknowledged and on the table, what, you know, is there any authentic power for women in these brigades? What are they doing? What is the position that they're playing? Or are they just instruments for, you know, this obviously really misogynistic policy and the aesthetics of neo-medievalism that you're talking about?
You know, that's a great question. And I haven't spoken to, obviously, to women right. in the Hamkanta brigade myself. But I have studied and spoken to women who are part of, you know, movements within Pakistan that are very supportive of jihadist ideology. And the difficult question within that realm is that if you look at it purely from the basis of women defying convention and women creating an alternative identity for themselves that breaks out of sort of the kind of traditional role of a wife and mother, which is still very dominant in Pakistan, then, you know, participation in these brigades and enacting and doing what they see as this sort of religious duty, you know, it is a form of agency within that very narrow realm, right? I mean, right. they're doing something beyond sort of a very, very traditionally circumscribed role. Of course, you know, for example, you know, as I point out in that article, the Al-Khamsa Brigade had no role, say, when, you know, several days later, several weeks later after their formation, the ISIS stoned a woman, or at least there was a video of a woman being stoned for adultery. So they didn't have a role in that, you know, they could protect that woman, which you would imagine as an all-women brigade, that would also, you know, be a part of what they do. So then that exposes sort of the, you know, the deceptions and the sort of vacuity of these concepts that supposedly, you know, ISIS can say we empower women by making this brigade and allowing them to do this. But of course, they don't allow women to protect other women, which then again shows that basically they're just there to just, they're just part of this sort of severely segregated realm where they say, okay, well, you know, men can't go and talk to these women because they're men, and so we'll send women to do it. But when it comes to sort of enforcing these sort of really draconian and punishments that are really baseless, even within Islamic doctrine, you know, the women cannot interfere within that sort of political statement that IS wants to make. So in all of these groups, you see that sort of that ceiling, right, or that limit to what they can do. The question, of course, then becomes, well, you know, and I'll give you a concrete example. When I was studying one such group in Pakistan, they told me that the girls who formed and women who formed this group, which also was, you know, going out and engaging in moral policing of other women. These are girls who have run away from very traditional backgrounds and were given refuge within a religious seminary where they were educated in Islam and before they started to do this moral policing. So when you look at that, you think, okay, wow, these are women that ran away and decided to do something different. But the way they've defined their emancipation is to sort of curtail the rights of other women. And that becomes then a very, very complicated question. But it is definitely one that needs to be asked, because as you can see, you know, I wrote this article maybe like a little over a week ago. Since then, there was a Nigerian female suicide bomber who detonated herself. And increasingly, there are more and more examples of women being not just recruited, but indoctrinated and then used for various sort of, you know, political aims and you know, and obviously for killing.
Right. So, yeah, and you also, you say yourself in the article, you talk about women acquiring this certain type of limited agency means becoming a pliant instrument of male power, or men, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. And but, you know, what do you do with that? I mean, ideally, feminism should prioritize gender identity. And so the women who are in these brigades, if it was truly something, should, you know, at least at a very basic sense, also be able to protect women from men.
Right.
And not just tell them when they should be covering their hair and, you know, what length their clothes should be and things like that. That they're not allowed to do at all. So you can see just how thin and vacuous then this concept is, because essentially what they're doing is finding some women and using them to exploit a much larger number of women and dividing that constituency so that, you know, they can never develop a collective sort of feminist conscience of any sort. At the same time, the immediate power promised by these jihadi groups, whether it's to men or women, is very appealing, you know, to a lot of women who do not have access to this sort of Western-style human rights discourse or to an education. And this is something that they work to make widely available precisely to those constituencies, you know, women who might be in very small towns and nowhere to go, who are only permitted to go to religious classes. This is a sort of path for them. that's available.
Right. So, and I feel like this is where our conversations usually go at some point, and this is one of the you know, one of the many reasons I think you're such an important writer and important voice is because, you know, I think when we talk about all of these issues and we talk about the Western relationship to them and Western foreign policy and or the internal dynamics, which we've been focusing on in this conversation, or how you define global human rights, global feminism, how do you engage with something like Boko Haram kidnapping those girls and really how horrific that was. And, of course, the genuine human desire to want to engage and participate and do something, but then at the same time recognizing that in a lot of ways participation can unfortunately kind of, you know, a broader context, a broader understanding for real systemic solutions can be elusive, basically. And a big part of that challenge is how do we engage with, again, what is really just objectively an obscene human rights situation and a genuine, I mean, you talk about there's potential long-term national security threats to the West from a group like ISIS. But there's also, I mean, talk about there's a deeply immediate threat that's already being experienced in Syrian and Iraqi communities. So, you know, this is the million-dollar question of this conversation, and we're always just maybe getting threads of it. But how do we engage these issues in a Western context? Not excuse them, not sort of try to go in that other side either, where, well, everything can just be sort of explained under an umbrella of colonial history or just our own hypocrisy, as important as those things are. But then at the same time, not just using them as our own sort of, again, our own neocolonial racist discourse to propagate all of the dysfunctional policies we want to propagate. What kind of conversations do we need to start having and actions we need to start taking to finding that third way?
Wow, that's an excellent question. And I have a piece coming out soon that I hopefully will come talk to you again about, which is precisely on this issue of what can be done. And, you know, I'm not sure I have an answer, but I will tell you how, what I think frames this dilemma. And I think the biggest factor that perhaps is not considered, you know, that for, you know, when we had the Bring Back the Girls campaign or other sort of hashtag campaigns that aim to be global and address the condition of these women, whether it's, you know, under Boko Haram or IS or any of these groups, is that I think one of the things that has deterred people from going beyond that and really asking, does this really help the women within these contexts, is the problem. We're afraid, and I would say that broadly in terms of human rights activists, in terms of people, journalists, us, commentators, we're afraid to ask that question. And that question points to the larger sort of mechanism that we believe, you know, globally still works, and that is, you know, we believe that naming and shaming these organizations globally, whether it's by hashtags or publicization of their crimes or, you know, honoring the survivors of their abuses, somehow helps create moral change locally, within these communities. And the problem with that assumption is two things. One is that these groups, whether it's Taliban or Boko Haram or anyone, are not really always counting on people agreeing and supporting them. Right. They're fine if people just do what they want them to do based on fear of them. You know, so
they're not saying, "Oh my God, we better get a PR firm on retainer."
Exactly.
Somebody at Wesleyan just put a hashtag on us.
Right. So that's one huge issue. And the other issue is that, the world has been really not interested in understanding the complexity of why these people are vulnerable to these groups. And, you know, like, for example, this is what I said. I mean, why would a woman join this? Well, because she doesn't really have the option of going to a university and, you know, taking a course on human rights and doing advocacy that way. So there are people who are sort of left out of the global discourse. And those are very specifically the ideas, you know, the areas in which extremist groups are most popular. And that's because this is their way of engaging in a counter-global discourse. And that is contributed to by the fact that they see their own governments, whether it's the Nigerian government, Pakistani government, as complicit in other crimes. So, you know, today Amnesty released a report on the crimes of the Nigerian military against the Nigerian people. So some of the people within that context, you know, who are suffering both the injustices of the Boko Haram and the Nigerian military.
Right.
So, you know, the frame through which they see something is then vastly different from the global frame, where people just say things like, okay, well, you know, let the military go and rescue these girls. Well, it's a lot more complicated than that. But the fact is that we've invested so much, you know, so much faith in the fact that our moral responsibility is limited to that click or that tweet or that hashtag, that people aren't really willing to push for a more robust form of global advocacy.
Well, that's exactly where it needs to start. Getting to that robust expression you're talking about, and hopefully, and I won't just say hopefully, I actually really do think that your writing in this conversation at least gives it some nudge in the right direction. So I really, really appreciate your time, Rafia Zakaria. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. I hope to be back soon.
Absolutely. Take care.
All right. Bye.
All right, folks. That was Rafia Zakaria. I think getting to those next layers of these conversations are absolutely vital. If we, you know, because I think though you see those tendencies, you see a mainstream tendency of not wanting to get behind in the context for anything, and then there's another tendency of like, well, you can't even talk about ISIS or something on its own terms because, you know, somehow taking those things on their own terms excuses Western foreign policy or something like that. And that's ridiculous. You need to be able to put everything on the table and deal with everything at once because everything's moving simultaneously at once. I mean, we've got this big, big, complicated chessboard of a world that we're all trying to figure out, but we got to include all the pieces that are on the board.
So, Alabama Republican Representative Mo Brooks, any relation, Michael?
Thank God, no.
Doesn't think that Republicans have a stance on immigration that could hurt the party's standing with Hispanic voters. I guess Mo Brooks is living in La La Land, where the ground is made of marshmallows and the trees pour chocolate. He does have...
That is, it's a white place called La La Land.
Come with me.
All right, go ahead.
But he does think that Democrats are, in fact, the ones calling for a war on a particular group of people. And who is that group? Well, let's listen to Representative Mo Brooks, a Republican of Alabama, on the Laura Ingraham radio program just this past, what was it, Sunday, it seems like.
Let's talk, though, about what the quote, lamestream media is saying about this. Ron Fournier, who's been on the show many times, from the National Journal, was on Fox News Sunday, Congressman Brooks, saying this.
The fastest growing voting bloc in this country thinks the Republican Party hates them. This party, your party, cannot be the party of the future beyond November if you're seen as the party of white people.
Pause it. So that was from Sunday. That was National Journal's Ron Fournier talking to Chris Wallace on Fox News on Sunday. You know, I think this is incredible coming from the National Journal that Ron Fournier realizes that the Republican Party is not going to be around very long as a national party if they don't start, accepting that other people of different backgrounds who aren't white are also American and, you know, they belong in this country. So yesterday, on Monday, this Representative Mo Brooks goes on Laura Ingraham, and let's continue.
Your reaction.
Well, this is a part of the war on whites that's being launched by the Democratic Party. And the way in which they're launching this war is by claiming that whites hate everybody else. It's a part of the strategy that Barack Obama implemented in 2008, continued in 2012, where he divides us all on race, on sex, greed, envy, class warfare, all those kinds of things. Well, that's not true, okay? And if you look at the polling data, every demographic group in America agrees with the rule of law, enforcing and securing our borders, and every one of them understands that illegal immigration hurts every single demographic group. It doesn't make any difference if you're a white American, a black American, a Hispanic American, an Asian American, or if you're a woman or a man. Every single demographic group is hurt by falling wages and lost jobs. And so the Democrats, they have to demagogue on this and try to turn it into a racial issue, which is an emotional issue rather than a thoughtful issue. If it becomes a thoughtful issue, then we win and we win big, and they lose big, and they understand that. And as they get more desperate, where they're going to argue race and things like that to a much heightened emotional state.
So let's, you know, of course, it's the immigrants coming to this country who are taking all the good old American jobs, you know, the jobs that the good old Americans already living in the country don't want to do. And it's not, you know, the loss of jobs and the lack of jobs and the falling wages have anything to do with the laws in this country, many supported and passed by Republican majorities that, you know, take away public sector jobs and make sure that corporations can continue to pay less money. You know, they fight against the minimum wage and they don't want to pass a living wage. You know, let's put aside those things. It's not all that. It's the American jobs being lost by the people coming into this country who are doing jobs that Americans weren't going to do to begin with. That's the problem here. But the war on whites, I mean, are you kidding me?
It's pretty incredible.
There's a war. These are the guys who refuse to believe that there's a war on women as they're going out there saying how women can just shut their bodies down if they're raped, so that if they actually do have a child, then they really wanted it. They weren't actually being raped. I mean, are you kidding me? This is the party that's cheering the Hobby Lobby decision that says that employers could choose not to give women contraception, which is part of a benefits package that they work for. I mean, are you kidding me here? There's a war on whites, though. All because we're calling them out on their racism. That's the war on the whites. That's what they view as the war on the whites. And he doubles down here. In a statement to AL.com, he responds to the controversy. As best I can in the time limitations I have. Oh, so he was taken out of context. I assume he's going to argue, right? I try to make sure people understand what the Democrats are doing by raising racism an issue every chance they get. Oh, I'm sorry, he's going to double down and not. The time limitations had absolutely nothing to do with it. Shocking, isn't it?
Wow.
I'm one of those who does not believe in racism. Now, this isn't. He's not saying here. I want to parse this here for you. He's not saying here he's not racist. He doesn't believe. I'm not a racist. I believe in equality for everybody. He's saying, I do not believe racism exists. So when white people talk shit about blacks, Hispanics, Asians, whatever, that's not racism. That's just the truth. Because racism doesn't exist. That's what he's arguing here. I just want to make sure you understand that. I believe everyone should be treated as equally as American citizens. So if you're not an American citizen, you don't matter, according to him. It's high time folks started calling out the Democrats for their racial appeals. Certainly, if you were to flip the coin and a white person were to say, vote for me because I'm white, it would be an uproar and deservedly so. So why do we allow blacks to say, vote for me because I'm black, or Hispanics to vote for me because I'm Hispanic? I have never – where is he seeing this?
I have no clue.
They assume that because blacks liked Obama, because, you know, maybe they see – you know, he can sort of see where we're coming from here. He can vote, fight for policies that benefit us as opposed to other white presidents who have constantly put us down and not have passed policies that help us. Maybe that's what they see. Maybe it doesn't have to do with him being black. Because if it did, explain to me what the hell happened to Herman Cain. Race is immaterial, says a white man, Mo Brooks. And everybody ought to be treated the same. I agree. Everybody ought to be treated the same. And that's not what we see coming from the Republican Party or Mo Brooks. And just in case if you're wondering, remember, Mo Brooks said on Laura Ingraham's show that if we fight on this issue, we will win and win big, and Democrats will lose and they will lose big. Well, Laura Ingraham has made her career on the whole race issue. She's a race baiter amongst the best of the race baiters. Let's hear what she thinks. She, you know, if you win Laura Ingraham over, then this might be your Republican Party conservative winning issue, and Mo Brooks is right. Is he?
I don't think Raul Labrador would probably say there's a war on whites, though, Congressman, don't you? That's a little that characterization's a little out there.
That, right?
Oof. Maybe you should go back to La La Land, where whites walk on marshmallow paving roads, and they drink chocolate from the trees on that line their streets. Amazing. Just amazing to me. They live in an imaginary world where racism doesn't exist because white people are just telling the truth about blacks and Hispanics. So it is therefore not racist.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
But even Laura Ingraham was like, wait a second.
This actually isn't a winning platform.
I'm thinking we should head to the fun half.
I think we should. Sounds good to me.
I think that you freebies out there have gotten enough nourishment for the day, frankly.
I agree. They've been nourished.
You have been nourished. Folks.
You have all of your political nutrients at this point in time.
You really do. Let's be real about
it. If you need any supplements, you have to become a member.
Oh, well, I mean, let's be real about this show. What show? And because Sam, I'm sure, isn't listening, I feel comfortable saying this. What show is led by, you know, Sam Cedar? Smart dude, has genuine conviction on these issues. Oh, and I tell you, you know, without naming names, not everybody in this field is still learning and still reading and still pushing and talking to people and pushing themselves to really give the best information possible, the best analysis possible. And Sam does it. I mean, that's how we do this show. Really is. I mean, when we're not making obnoxious jokes, and when I'm not figuring out ways of avoiding the guest list, we're actually really having a conversation and figuring stuff out. That's why we've been covering Gaza and you know, that situation the way we have. Because, and you know, and I'll tell you, you know, for Sam, there's huge stakes in it. There's huge stakes in it for all of us, because frankly, there are, you know, for people in the past, there have been professional consequences, frankly, speaking more even-handedly about that issue.
Hell, there's some people who won't even talk about it because they don't want to.
There's some people who don't want to talk about it. They don't want the heat. But that's not how we operate. And also, I would say, very few other places you get an interview with Rafia Zakaria and the very high likelihood of incredibly obnoxious and funny impressions in the fun half.
Listen,
what other show has brought you Right Wing Mandela? I mean, this podcast is like a combination of like Democracy Now, Council on Foreign Relations, The Chappelle Show, and like a friggin' Occupy rally. I mean, this is good.
Where else are you going to hear such glowing reviews of a show's host on their own show?
I wasn't talking about me. I was talking about us as a team. If you're watching visually, I'm throwing the Sharpie at Matt. I gave the little bastard a warning so he was able to move his head. And he's making it really obvious that he's about to throw it back at me right now.
I'm just trying to find it so I don't, like, trip and fall.
You would. That's how.
That's totally something I would do.
Wow, you really are low to the ground that you could trip and fall at a Sharpie.
Not technically trip, like step on it and slide. You know how.
Step on it and slide. All right, but seriously, folks, become a member today. One of the reasons this show really can be, good and honest and everything else is obviously because you are the multiple bosses, and we do it for you. So become a member today at MajorityReport/become a member. Download the app, Majority App. I always forget the address of the app. What's the app?
Majority App. It's MajorityApp.com.
MajorityApp.com. Coffee.
JustCoffee.coop for all your fair trade coffee and chocolates. Use coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off your entire order. Also, you could support this show by buying all your junk through Amazon. Use our Amazon link, MajorityReportKickback.com. That will forward you right to Amazon. You will notice absolutely no difference, except that link also forwards you to our version of Amazon that simply gives us a small kickback when you place your order. You notice no difference from what's being offered to you, the prices you receive from Amazon.com's homepage or whatever. You just help us out by buying it through MajorityReportKickback.com. How else can you support this show? You can also support this show by subscribing to our YouTube channel. It's free, just like the app, youtube.com/SamSeder. Follow us on Twitter, at Majority FM, and then like us on Facebook, facebook.com/MajorityReport.
We post not only the show on Facebook, we post clips from YouTube that we've done. We will occasionally post a really great article or a really great clip.
And if you have a Facebook or Twitter, we're going to start revving up our use now of Donate Your Account. It's a great way if you don't always get a chance to watch the videos or whatever. One video or show a day, we will simply share out to your friends on Facebook and Twitter automatically. When we used it a lot, I'm going to start ramping up the use of it again. But when we were using it a lot, people were giving us glowing reviews about how, their friends were interacting with them on Facebook and Twitter about, oh, this is a great story. Thanks for sharing this with me. And it's just a great way to support the show and spread knowledge with your friends and family.
We drop the knowledge so you can spread the knowledge.
Oh.
All right. To join the show, the IMs are on 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We will see you all on the flip side.